Yeah, so it was really high just being higher than low. Yeah, so the because we're interested in the guys that are at zero, essentially. They're the dangerous ones. So you know, you're interested in some energy range, whatever it is, and then you think maybe the smallest photon you could never measure, we'll call that lambda, and then we'll call capital lambda our mathematical cutoff, which is smaller than little lambda. And then what we're going to do is we'll calculate how things depend on capital lambda to be logarithmically divergent, like we saw, and then what we'll find is that these graphs will give us something logarithmically divergent. Then the sum of the photon emission graphs gives us something also logarithmically divergent, but where it'll depend on the log ratio, log of this ratio, because once you produce the photons, then you care how much energy they had. And so the logarithms of lambda will cancel, but you'll be left with a log of this little lambda in your answer, which is your resolution. And so so the cancellation of the infrared divergences doesn't mean there's no physics there. There could be actually a very big logarithm of a ratio of scales that you might not have known was there, but the cancellation of lambda is telling you how to find it.
Like, you can have a virtual photon that's both hard and soft.
Right.
Everything.
Right.
Hardness.
Yeah. And I'm interested in the divergences happening at the low end. So I'm just basically ignoring everything that's going on at higher end. And I'm just, because of that, approximating everything where I can take the leading piece, which is diverging. And that's what this factorization is doing. And so I was about to rewrite it, but I probably don't have to rewrite it because it's here. Everything is using this thing there that you know, when we emit a photon, or if we connect two of them, the basic thing is this thing, you know, including that line. And that's the thing that we worked out here was somewhere. Yeah, it's this thing. So the, you know, these factors turned into these factors in the limit that K is small. If we're only focusing on the things that will diverge as capital lambda goes to zero, the lower limit of our integration range for, and these integral d4k's, I'm imagining going from capital lambda to infinity or something, and this end might diverge too. But I'm focusing on the dependence on capital lambda and things that obstruct you taking it to zero.
So how does this affect like the divergence of that graph? You've drawn some graphs.
Yeah.
Raise it now.
Yeah. The one where I connected it. Yeah. Where I actually emit something, in. Like that one?
You do a horizontal line.
Yeah.
And then from the bottom.
Yeah.
Two,
like that.
Yeah. How is that, like, explicitly? How does the, like, the soft end hardness affect the divergence of this graph?
How does the what affect the divergence?
The hardness of the.
So what's going to happen here is if you actually write this out, you know, you've got an integral, so this is k1 and k2, two little graphs that the two integrals are going to do. You're going to get integral d4k1, d4k2, and then this stuff will all give you stuff which goes like 1 over k to the fourth. You know, it's k1 is some power, k2
is power. I can't see the other board that you're writing on it.
Hi, Josh. Yeah, hi. Thanks.
Thanks.
So there's some powers of K1 and K2 here. Thanks for telling us, Afshin. And they're going to sum to 8, so that there'll be a divergence in this joint integral. There'll be a divergence as at the lower end here. And that's the thing I'm focusing on. I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to take that, and then we'll given that all of these divergences are happening when we've got a photon attaching to an external line, a soft photon attaching to an on-shell hard line. You know, once we've identified this factor, the next thing I'm going to do is connect them all together with all possible photons, and that'll catch all loops like this. And then we'll also take the case where they're being emitted, and we'll contract them with polarization vectors and sum those up and see how the answer depends on capital lambda. So that's the goal.
So when you say, like, what if one of the photons is soft?
Yeah. If they're both soft, it's going to diverge. Yeah. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to imagine that you've defined some process where you've included everything above some scale. Let's say so the energy of interest to you is this. There's some scale which in practice might be the resolution of your detector or something, which is also in your problem then. And then this is some mathematical regularization thing. And so I'm imagining that we'll define the hard part of the problem to be everything above some arbitrary spot here. You choose it. And you draw all the graphs, you evaluate them, and you get this M for that. And it'll depend on exactly where this line is. And then we're going to now say we're going to add all the soft photons everywhere. And when you add them in the middle here, it doesn't do it. It doesn't matter because it doesn't change, doesn't make it something diverge here. But the ones that you add on the external lines are the ones that will be the only places in the graph where you were going to get something which was diverging as lambda went to zero. So we're just focusing on that part of it. Good. So the basic thing we're looking at is we've got some hard process with a bunch of external lines. And that's got some amplitude m beta alpha. So this is, imagine that the initial state is alpha, final state is beta or something like that. And then we've done the process of adding one soft photon to it with momentum k. And the upshot was that the amplitude for the part of this, call it m tilde, or let's call it m mu beta alpha, which is the amplitude with this guy included. And I'm gonna leave open the Feynman rule for this last piece. I'm gonna later on allow myself to do this in a bunch of lines and either contract them with propagators or contract them with polarization vectors. So let's just start with adding one. And the upshot of that whole board over there was that this was this factor. This factor. So it's if this is, the example I did was I took a case where P was coming out, I think. Okay, P. This became P mu over K dot P minus I epsilon times M beta alpha. Everything else was the same, right? So this thing that you had before I added this is this, and then now I add this extra piece, and for the soft part of it, the thing that's dangerous in the infrared is basically this factor times the thing you had before, is the upshot of all that. If I had done that on an initial line, the only difference is, this would be the relative direction of K compared to P is going to change, right? Here P is in, K is out. Here they were both out. So that's going to basically change the sign of K here. So what I'll do is I'll put a factor eta, which will say this is line N. Eta will be plus one if it's an outgoing line. It'll be minus one if it's ingoing. And I should have put it here, but what I'll do instead is I'm going to multiply through by eta everywhere. And so I'm going to put eta here. And that'll also mean it's here. But effectively, it was just a sign change of k. That was all that happened. So eta is plus eta n is plus one if n is outgoing, and it's minus one if n is incoming. And that'll be important because when we do the integrals over these momenta at some point, these I epsilons are going to play a role. And we're going to do them in the complex plane. And keeping track of the sign is going to be important for that exercise. OK. And if I do this repeatedly, so if I do this on kind of, let's say I do it on two lines, if I do it like I did here, all I'm going to just do is I'm going to have more factors, right? So if I had this particular example where I have a new, K1, mu1, say, mu2, k2, then I'm going to get, in that case, m mu1, mu2, eta alpha. It'll just be two factors, that eta, let's say this is n and this is line m, or maybe n1 and n2 might be better. I'll have k eta 1, or eta n1, p1 mu1 over k dot P1 minus I eta N1 epsilon. n2. Let me just say eta1 just because I don't have to write the n's all the time. Eta2 p2 mu2 over k dot p2 minus I eta2 epsilon times m beta alpha. And so as long as I keep putting the photons on set on distinct lines, I'm just going to get factors like that. But what, if I put them on the same line, then we have to be careful about, you know, do I put them like that or do I put them like that? There's an ordering issue. And so let's think that one through. And what I want to do is I want to, for the case where I've got n photons added, I want to know what this amplitude is. And then we'll contract the various dangling indices with a propagator and do the integral over the loop. Or we'll contract it with a polarization vector and sum over the particles being produced. But this will be a factor in both those things, so I want to keep track of that. Sorry?
Is it K1
and K2, thank you.
Yeah. Is this a thing we, like, is this sort of thing we have to worry about in both the sort of framework of canonical quantization and half-life curls?
Yeah, it's in both of them. It's just a, because, you know, this is basically I'm just using Lorentz invariant Feynman rules here. So those would be the ones that the path integral would just give you. And those would be the ones you'd end up with after all the cancellations happen. We talked about it in the canonical thing, but they're the ones that are still there. So this is something which is everybody will give you.
So the Feynman rules are agnostic to the framework in which you're
to the covariant parts of them. But if we had derived the Feynman rules, you know, honestly, in terms of the Hamiltonian, we would have also had a bunch of non-covariant Feynman rules coming from these, like the Coulomb interaction for the electromagnetic field. And then the propagator for the electromagnetic field would have had an n mu n nu term in addition to the ones I talked about. And then the cancellation of the various graphs would have gone through, but those Feynman rules would have had to incorporate that those were part of the graph.
Right. So as long as we're talking about the covariant ones,
yeah, if you focus on the covariant ones, then they give you the same answer. Right. Okay, so let's think about this case where we, we're basically focusing on the case where we imagine putting on more than one here. So we have K1, mu1, A2, mu2. And so that's going to be, you know, M1, M2, beta alpha. So it's going to be, you know, the same arguments as before are going to apply each time. So I'm going to get two factors, but the momenta involved will be different, right? Because if this is a P, this will be a P minus K2. This will be a P minus K2 minus K1. So what will happen is we'll get this guy will give us a factor of this. So we'll have eta n, or eta, whatever the eta is for this line. Times p mu 1 over k2 dot p minus I eta epsilon. And then the other one will give me, so once I've done that, then this propagator went away, right? And then I'll have eta. When k gets small, this p minus k2 is p as far as this is concerned, so we have p mu2 divided by, but now we have k1 dot p2. This is too easy. Something, what am I doing wrong? Let me make sure I'm not lying to you too badly. Yes, right. So remember where this k came from. That k came from that's the momentum flowing in the fermion line, right? Because what we really had in the fermion propagator was p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon, and it was the p of whatever was here. And when I wrote it out as being p minus k2, expanded it out, that's where the k2 came from. But if I do that here, it's going to see k1 plus k2 here. So I'm going to get k1 plus k2 dot p minus m alpha. Whereas if we do it the other way around, if I instead switch the, you know, attach this photon here, I'm just going to switch one with two, right? So I should add to that, you know, eta p mu, eta squared is going to be one, so I'm going to get p mu one, p mu two, divided by, now I'll have k1 dot p minus I eta epsilon, and I'll have k1 plus k2 dot p minus I eta epsilon. But you can kind of see that now if I add these together, get all the common factors, what's going to happen is I'm going to get a common factor here, but I'm going to get, so I get 1 over k2 dot p plus 1 over k1 dot p. That's going to be common denominator. It'll be k1 plus k2 dot p divided by k1 dot p, k2 dot p. Then that will cancel out that. And so in the end of the day, this will be, we're going to write this where you can see that. So if I sum those together, what's happening is we're getting mu1, mu2, beta alpha is, we've got the eta squared's gone, but I'll write it anyway because if we had do it n times, we'll have eta to the n. P mu1, P mu2 divided by, that factor is canceled and I just have the k1 dot p, k1 dot p, k2 dot p. And so the upshot is that when I add them together, I got the same thing I got for the independent ones on the external lines. That means that if I now imagine taking a graph where I stick them all over the place, we can do the exercise of adding again, and it happens again. So the bottom line is when you add them all up, either multiply putting things on the one line or putting them all on different lines, they're all giving you basically the same factor as if they were all independent. So if I have a graph with n photons, n soft photons attached to external lines, it's going to give me m mu1 mu n. The dangerous part will be, you know, it'll be a product over all of the external lines we're talking about. So these are product over the n is labeling which external line we're interested in. And we'll have eta n p n mu I guess I should do product over I equals 1 to n, and then n sub I, little n sub I will be the line I attach photon I to. I'll have eta n I p n I mu I over AI dot ENI minus I eta NI epsilon alpha. So that's the starting point that we want to work with.
So the other part over there, like where you swap K1 and K2, it's basically the symmetry factor, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a right. So if you add them all up, then it's as if you had them all independently distributed on independent lines. There's no additional factors of two or anything, factors of n here. Because I'm interested in I'm taking the amplitude, and I have two photons, and I want to stick them on. And I want to know what's the, and I want to claim that the answer is always this. And so the algebra is different if I put the photons on different lines or put them on the same line, because the same line I could have done this way or I could have attached it this way, and those have the same external labels. And so I have to add those amplitudes if I want to give you the amplitude for this final process where all I specify is this. I don't get to specify where it happens. I'm always supposed to sum over all options in the internal part of a Feynman graph. Okay, so let's put that up here. Okay, so now let's do the infrared divergence. Let's take the let's contract them and make propagators first.
This last result we have, this is just for when they're all hitting the same incoming.
No, this is true now for doesn't matter where they hit, because that would have been just true by inspection when I had them on independent lines, because that's just what happened. And then the non-trivial thing was when I put them in the same line, when I added the two, I got the same answer because of this.
Is there like some overall counting factor? Because it feels like there would be a lot of different, if I have like two incoming photons, it feels like there would be a lot of more ways to have them on different lines.
When I start connecting them, then I'll have to take care of that. So I'll have to make sure I don't multiply count. And that's why I'm looking at my notes here, because that's the thing that, all right. So now what we're going to do now is take all of these cases and what happens when if I just pair them off and make these into soft, soft loops. So the rule is I have to take that M, I have to pair off in pairs of indices with the photon propagator, do the integral over K, and keep track of all the symmetry factors. So let me call the answer we'll pair off these ends with a photon propagator. And we'll call it and do the loop. So, and there'll be more than one of them. So I'll call it M tilde beta alpha. Since we've paired off all the photons, there's no longer any dangling indices mu. And that's going to be given by, let me take this. There'll be a sum over, so what I'm each term here will have, I'll take N equals 2K. It's only going to matter if I have an even number of vertices, if I want to pair them all off. So I'll take that. So the N that was appearing here is going to be 2k. And I'm going to sum from k equals 0 to infinity. And it's going to be, get all the factors right. These are the symmetry factors, which I'll write them and then explain where they came from in a second. What I told you about capital lambda and little lambda was backwards in my notes. I'm going to use what I'm doing with my notes, otherwise I'll never get anything right. We'll have minus I d4k. So this is just the photon propagator. 2 pi to the fourth is what. Then we've got these factors here. But I've got the sum over all the pairs of lines with an eta m times the charge on that line. I'll write that as qn. It's pn mu divided by pn dot k minus I eta n epsilon. That's eta m qm pm nu eta mu nu. Let me put the eta we knew over here. So this is pm dot I eta m. Close that. And I've got k powers of that, because it's every pairing gives me the same factor, the integral over the photon momentum times the two lines that photon connected to. K was a bad letter to use, yes. Yes.
You need more letters.
It's a capital font in my notes, so it's. What's that? Yeah. S is actually gonna look like five. Let me say R. R factorial. The R. Close the bracket. So the square bracket's pretty clear, right? Because you're just gonna get that factor R times because you had that many loops. Then the symmetries are coming about because one of these things has a minus sign. The minus sign is there because whenever I take, let's say these are the two guys, N and M, the photon is leaving from one end and it's entering the other end, so that in that counting argument, K is, has one of them, K has the opposite sign to the way I gave it to you, the way I derived it, and so that's why that sign is there. And then the, right, now the 2 to the K is coming, or 2 to the R, is coming because we're counting, you know, we were counting things denumerably. And so we essentially, if we didn't have this factor of 2, we would be overcounting because we'd count this as being the same as this, with the photon going the other way, because what we really had were a bunch of n's, and we stuck a propagator on them, and then it didn't matter which way, mu1 and mu2, it didn't matter which one we had. And so we would be overcounting if we didn't divide by the 2 to the r, because that's the permutation of the fact that these two mu's, we only need the symmetric pair of them. We're not counting the number of ways in which we could have had a mu1 and mu2 where the order mattered. And the R factorial is the case where, this is the one that always makes me think. I think every time I do this, I have to kind of go through this again. But basically, it's the statement that so when we do this sum here, we're not distinguishing between the fact that the photons. So we're counting these graphs as distinct from one another. Say, if photon one was here and photon two was here, that's not different than photon two being on this loop and photon one being on that loop. So the you know how we label the photon is something which doesn't matter, because these are just dummy labels. And there are factorial labelings of these k's. Once we specify, you know, the summing over the n's is redundant unless we divide by the number of ways in which we could have been pairing off the photons.
What is Q?
Q is the charge of the particle here. Previously, for an electron, that would be minus E. But I kind of want to make a point later on. So Q is the charge of that line. Yeah. So we're imagining that we have a bunch of charged particles. And I'm only putting that in because I want to show you there's a consistency condition. I forgot back, I could already show you that probably. So we're going to be worried about whether this divergence has little lambda goes to zero, because that's the divergent part. And that's the region where this factorization is true. And there's an m beta alpha, I forgot it, right? And then this capital lambda is where we decided to separate hard from soft photons. It's just it's the thing in my, you know, when I drew a picture but erased it. You know, lambda is this IR regulator. And capital lambda separates what we mean by hard from what we mean by soft. So it's some arbitrary thing.
It's not the UV cutoff, but it is the UV
cutoff. No, so the physics we're interested in is here somewhere, and then the UV cutoff is way up there. So. So the important thing is that this, you know, this sum, you can do the sum. It's an exponential, right? So it's so So a short way of writing that would be that m tilde beta alpha is, I'm going to call it curly f, and it depends on everything. It depends on little lambda, capital lambda, and other things, times m beta alpha. And m beta alpha also depends on capital lambda, right? Because that's the split between hard and soft will move things from here to here. And for this factorization to happen, we want this range between little lambda and big lambda all to be very soft, right? Because we want to, because we've made that approximation in making this explicit in writing things like this, for example. and curly f is just this, and so it's the exponential of 1/2. I'm going to call it capital F, and that, so the half is just getting rid of that, and so this is capital F. That's the minus I, the integral from little lambda to capital lambda, d4k. And then I sum over an m of that stuff.
I had a question. So it's a bit like off topic, but like in QED, like do we have any situation where there's where the theory cannot decouple like the high energy and low energy, and there's some UV-IR mixing? Is there a situation?
Depends on what that means. The UVIR mixing is a word, it's things that people like to talk about, where it's hard to really pin down what exactly they meant. And so...
I'm just thinking like what that would mean physically.
Yeah, and that I think no one really knows. At some level, you know, at some trivial level, this is UVIR mixing because it knows about everything. You know, it's something which depends on all the variables in the problem. And unless you show that it's breaking up into a different scales are separating.
But it decouples in like a very neat way, this thing, right?
I mean, this factoring. Yeah, but that's a very specific to, so this infrared piece, the divergent piece is factoring, but the whole thing isn't necessarily factoring in any interesting way.
So, is it like in special in QED, or are there any theories that could not do this?
Well, the thing that's dangerous would be if I could have, if you start making these electrons massless, then you have problems not just with soft photons, but if you have collinear photons, then they become dangerous too. If the electron and the photon are kind of traveling together, and the electron is constantly radiating photons, that does something that's not here. That's what non-abelian gauge theories do, right? Because the gluons are massless and they're coupled to gluons. So this exercise would not be sufficient to get rid of the infrared problem for non-abelian gauge theories. But if you summed over initial particles being absorbed as well as being emitted, then that would make it. Then that's a theorem that's always infrared finite. That's the KLN theorem. Kaneshita, Lee, and Naumburg. And so that's something which applies everywhere. But for specific cases, so for gravity, for example, you might have thought gravity would be like non-abelian gauge theory in that the gravitons can emit gravitons. But the thing is that the coupling of the graviton to the graviton is momentum dependent. So the charge is really a P there. So everything's a little bit less infrared dangerous than it would have been otherwise. And so in the gravity case, the same exercise would go through. And there was I wanted to make the point about, I should have made the point back here. I've been saying that there's this connection between gauge invariance, water densities, and conservation of charge, which is current conservation. And you can kind of see that also
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems to me like we have the machinery to talk about gravity.
Yeah.
It's sticking a G mu to the A mu.
Yeah.
Et cetera.
Yeah. Weinberg did that for this in 1964.
Right.
So yeah. It's been around for a long time, yeah.
But so is that not good enough, or do we have to quantize it also?
No, this is fully quantum, right? This is a quantum. If you just did the same thing for the, take the Einstein action and you linearize it, and or you not linearize it, but you expand it around a background, say flat in this case, and treat the fluctuation as an operator and just do the thing I did for the photon. There's a similar story for the graviton, that it's, you can't represent a spin 2 massless object with a symmetric tensor, it turns out, for the same reason you can't represent a spin 1 with a vector, but you can represent it by something with the symmetry properties of the Weyl tensor. And if you do the story that Weinberg gives you, then the if you write that as a sum over, you know, D3K and sum over polarizations, and you ask what's the polarization vector, it has the property that it's a bunch of derivatives on something which looks like a symmetric tensor. But if you ask how does it transform, it's not a tensor. It's a tensor up to some sort of a gauge transformation, which is a coordinate transformation in this case.
I guess my question is, why do you need that at all? Like, why do you need to quantize the gravitational field at all?
Well, no one can force you to.
Well, I know, just like, is it not just good enough to have a curved geometry?
Well, I would say that that might be the way the world works, but then you have the problem of you don't have a global picture of everything, right? You don't have a one system in which I get to describe all the interactions I see, because you've got a special rule for gravity, because we don't know how to quantify how quantum mechanics and gravity play with each other. So that essentially means you've got an uncontrolled theoretical error in anything that sees both quantum mechanics and gravity, which may be the way things work. Maybe you wouldn't understand that, but that's not required. So this picture where you have general relativity and the standard model or QED or whatever, and you just treat them with a good old-fashioned quantum mechanics, that actually works. And it's so the conservative point of view is we should push that until it breaks down, but there's no evidence it breaks down, which is kind of, it's interesting, right, that's true. It doesn't mean that there's not something else going on, but it's good to know when you're forced to do something as opposed to when you're choosing to do something.
Right. Sorry, did you, that last little bit, so.
For this?
What you were just saying. QFT, right, until it breaks down. Isn't like the breakdown when you get to GR? Is this
no, so that's one of the things that in the 60s they would have told you. They would have said what they would have said is that in this story, general relativity is not renormalizable. And so then they'd say that this divergent story in ultraviolet isn't solved, is what they would say. But we now understand that that was actually a red herring. That, you know, there are lots of non-renormalizable theories in nature. And we know how to, like the weak interactions used to be non-renormalizable. And we know how to quantize them. And we know how to systematically make predictions that you can test. And that story I was mentioning over on that board this morning about, you know, if you're working, what you have to appreciate is that if you have coupling, like the Newton's constant, which goes like 1 over mass to some power, in this case squared, you have to appreciate that what you're really doing, you have no option to be doing anything different than the calculations you're doing only make sense in the context that you're doing an expansion in the energy of interest to you divided by that mass, whatever it was. So in that case, it's a squared. But if you work to any fixed order in that expansion, then it's completely predictive. And it just all the rules of quantum mechanics go through. You can renormalize everything. The further you go down the series, the more things you have to renormalize. But that just says that you're a Lagrangian. The Lagrangian you got, so really in this bigger picture, you know, you're calculating some path integral over the light fields, the graviton, let's say, other light fields, but also a lot of heavy fields, you know, e to the I action. So maybe the string theorists, when I was a student, people said this might happen, but no one has an example. But now string theory claims to be an example where you actually, in string theory, you could do these path integrals, and the answer is 6. There's no divergences, it's just an answer. And in that picture, though, most of those things are really heavy. So we do the integrals over the light guys last, the heavy guys first. We call that e to the I action of the light guys, g and any other light fields. And that thing is what we're calling the classical action. And so we shouldn't expect it just to be the Lagrangian. It should be coming to us as with lots of corrections to it, because it's an integral. It's some god-awful thing. It's amazing that it would be local. But it is local if you're expanding in inverse powers of whatever the heavy thing is you're looking at. But then you should expect to get all possible interactions, but they'll be organized in a derivative expansion because that's the expansion you're doing. So for gravity in particular, you should be expecting to get, you know, root g, a number, no derivatives, something with 2 derivatives, and the coefficient you'll call the Planck mass squared, but something with, you know, 4 derivatives, and those should all be there. And the statement is that to any fixed order in this, where that's the Planck mass, will involve some number of these guys, but some fixed number of those guys. And so you can always renormalize all of your divergences into these coefficients, but it might be more than just the Planck scale. You might need this one, for example. But that's some finite number of things. Once you've done that, you've got an infinite number of things you can predict. You have to get three of them you'll use to measure these three things, but then after that you predict everything. And that works fine for gravity. But you can't, doesn't mean there's no quantum gravity problem, because you're forced to be only asking low energy questions in that picture. Whereas the string theorists would say, or other people do quantum gravity, say that they actually can calculate for arbitrary energies, they can give you an answer. But as far as all observations go, you don't need that. So if when someone says they're testing classical gravity in the solar system, you could ask, that for that to make any sense, the theoretical error had to be, had to be finite. And agreement means that the theoretical and experimental errors overlap. But that means you had to have theoretical errors. And in this case, you can quantify what your quantum gravity effects, what your error is, what you didn't include, and it's super small. So that's why the classical approximation, you can print a proof for gravity that the leading order piece is classical general relativity. And the corrections to it are these. So the things that are counting loops in that case is this ratio. And so that's, having that be small is why classical gravity works. And if you don't have that, if you abandon that and say that we're going to do something mysterious with gravity, then you essentially don't have any theoretical control over what your errors are. Then it's not clear that it makes sense to compare classical calculation to the observations, because you don't really know. You know that quantum mechanics exists, so then the question is, how do you quantify what your error was on the theoretical side? And it might be that that's the way things work, and maybe you can quantify it, but you don't. This framework does everything, and so to improve on it, you need to do better, or as well as. And so anybody who hands you a theory who does something more radical, you should ask them, so now quantify what the error is when I look at classical tests of general relativity in the solar system. How do I know your quantum effects are small? And it's surprising how many proponents of theories can't answer that question. And it's not because they're not trying. Often the theory itself is designed in a way where it's hard to get near flat space. And so it's I would say that the state of the art is when I say the standard model, to me that means general relativity and the standard model understood in this way, very predictive, very specific about what its corrections are. You look at Hawking radiation, quantum effects that are gravitating, you believe them because the Hawking temperature essentially is small compared to the Planck mass, so there's a systematic approximation you're making. The curvatures are not large at the horizon, and so it all makes sense. The quantum effects are small, but they're competing with zero because the classical effect is zero in that case, and so it's you didn't have to leave the domain of validity of your approximations to do anything. That's an important perspective. It needn't be, in the end of the day, the right one, but if you step away from it, you have to then go back and ask, why does anything work? Because this is all kind of basically encoding decoupling, that short distances don't matter much for long distances, so that's why you can make predictions. That's my soapbox. Okay, the thing I wanted to say was, there's just a point in passing. I can't remember where I wrote it. I want to say it because it's actually a nice observation. The problem with these notes is that I need to go through and organize them, because everything's in here, but it's always hard to find this section in particular is spread out everywhere. Where is the? Yes, here we go. I should have actually said this before. Right. So this is something I put my talk down somewhere. So the observation when I first derived m mu, remember that was the thing where we had something and we just asked one photon came off with index mu, and that was basically, that was momentum p, it was p mu times, if I put the charge in, it would have been, if I attach it to any, all possible lines, if I ask what's the amplitude for having one of these guys, and I, but because I can't specify where it goes, I have to sum over all the external lines, I would have had sum over n, where n is the external line, I would have had pn mu over pn dot k minus I eta epsilon times whatever the basic hard process was. Now this is an example of an amplitude essentially. If I could, because it's now I could put a polarization vector for the photon on this, and so it should in particular satisfy that if I take k mu on m mu, it should be zero very very generally independent of that factor. And you can kind of see what's happening in that case. If you do that, then the p dot k you're going to get cancels that p dot k. I would have had the charge of the line n there if I put the charges in. And so what happens when I evaluate this is it's a sum over n of qn, basically, times m beta alpha times a to n. And remember, a to n is plus 1 for all the incoming particles and minus 1 for the outgoing particles. So it's basically q for the final state, or the initial state, minus q for the final state times m beta alpha. And so you can kind of see that it is zero, but it's zero because charge is conserved, that you knew that the charge, the initial charge and the final charge was different. And if you had done the same exercise, and this is what Weinberg showed in 1964, if you'd done the same exercise for a graviton, then what would have happened is, you know, you would have had a mu nu, and you would contract a polarization of a graviton, and what the graviton would have given you, m mu nu, would have been sum over n, same story basically, a to n, and p n mu, the charge turns into another p, divided by p dot k. Where, and then you could have had a coupling constant. So let's put in a coupling constant f n. So let's imagine that the coupling of any particle to the graviton is proportional to its energy as it is, and the special case of general relativity is that Fn would just be, you know, the square root of 8 pi times Newton's constant, and so it would be the same for all n is the general relativity case. But you could have done this, asked this question for soft gravitons in the same way, and the same argument says that, you know, because of general covariance, the fact that in this language the way you're seeing the general covariance has to happen is that it's the same as for the gauge invariance for the photon, that if I have a massless spin 2 field, the thing that I represent it with is the Weyl tensor, and if I want to describe it in terms of thing, it comes as derivatives of something which is not a tensor, which is the metric tensor, and if I want to have interactions as a function of that metric tensor, it will only be Lorentz invariant if that metric tensor has gauge invariances, and the gauge invariances will be the linearized ones that you get for gravity, or some C. And so that whole story says that there should be a consistency condition like this for the graviton. And it's true that it is there, that if you again contract with K, these guys cancel again. But in the graviton case, the thing that should be zero is sum over N of eta N En nu times Fn, if Fn was different from zero, not divided by anything, and m beta alpha. And so if f doesn't depend on n, then this is going to be zero for the same reason this was, because four momentum is conserved, right? So it's the same story we'll go through, that energy momentum conservation will make this consistency condition equal to zero. And if f did depend on n, you can actually prove that you can't make this work, because that would mean that you have a conserved four vector in addition to momentum. And there's a theorem, the Coleman-Mandula theorem, which in the Lorentz invariant theory, which has an S matrix, which is not the unit matrix, and it's not conformal invariant, then the most general symmetry group you can have is the Poincaré group times things that commute with the Poincaré group. And so the four vector that's not four momentum would not do that. And so that the So there's a very kind of powerful handlet for the very soft limit for gravitons that points you towards general relativity, and it's because you're essentially building in the symmetries that are in general relativity. But the graphical expansion around any specific space time, it doesn't have to be flat space, but in this case it's flat space, has a lot of the structure that's in things like general relativity. So those consistency relations are kind of built into these amplitudes, is the message there. So I wanted to, in the notes, I have there's a long song and dance where you evaluate these integrals. Let me just tell you what the answer is, because otherwise we're going to run out of time. And so, there's a whole bunch of nice, you should read the Weinberg 1964 paper is really a beautiful paper, because if I write this as, there's a whole bunch of consistency checks you can do here, one of which is, I want to write F in a kind of a more specific way here, so let me do that, because I'm going to quote what the answer is for...
Sorry, what is the Weinberg paper?
This is, it's Infrared Photons and Gravitons, I think it's called, and it's I think it's 1964, but it's the mid-60s sometime. So let me write this in a more explicit way. So F, I want to write it as, so there's 1 over 2 pi to the fourth, just because that's the way things work. We'll do the sum last. There's these eta n's are going along the front of the ride. There's the charges. And there's these momenta that are kind of in the numerators. Pm nu, or actually they're contracted because we did the photons, contracted them. And then there's a thing jnm, which is the integral. And I'm just going to quote for you what the integral is. And the integral, it contains the consistency things that are in this paper are very nice, because there's a real part to the integral, there's an imaginary part to the integral. The imaginary part is telling you, it turns off when the particles involved are, if I have two pairs of particles, one in the final state, one in the initial state, the imaginary part turns off. But if I have pairs of particles where they're both in the initial state or both in the final state, it's not zero, and it's the Coulomb phase that you had to have between two charged particles when they were interacting with each other. So it's that thing works. And then there's the real part has the structure that if you had classically, you'd asked if I had a bunch of charges that came in, then changes their velocities all of a sudden as they are in the scattering. That's what the hard thing is describing. There would have classically been Bremsstrahlung from that, because you've made these things accelerate. And the leading rate you get from this is exactly the classical Bremsstrahlung rate. So it's showing you that the low energy limit, the summing over these photons, you know, the logic of summing over these photons is, if I just, you might have said, you know, we're summing up a whole bunch of graphs that are, each loop costs a factor of alpha over 4 pi. So the nth loop is way down in this alpha expansion. And the only reason it makes sense to resum it is it's being multiplied by logarithms of things like capital lambda over little lambda, because it's diverging. And so these can all compete with each other because we're so sensitive to the infrared. And so it only makes sense to be summing these graphs because they're all contributing at order one, which I can make, no matter how small this is, I can make lambda small, you know, close enough to zero to make this order one. And so it's consistent to be thinking through the perturbation theory is breaking down at those small scales. And it's because of that that we have to worry about these higher order graphs, and we have to worry about the emission of many photons, which also would have cost many powers of alpha. So there's a very, very beautiful connection to kind of classical electromagnetism buried in here. But let me just say what the answer is, and then cut to the chase. So the definition of J is it's minus I integral of d4k divided by k squared minus I epsilon. And then we have these factors of 1 over pn dot k minus I eta n epsilon 1 over pm dot k I epsilon. That's its definition. And you evaluate it by residues. And I just want to tell you what it looks like. So actually, the way I'm going to tell it to you is, I'm going to tell you what curly F is. So the answer is that curly F, it's, you know, this, the integral is going to diverge, right? It's, we designed it, so this has got a 1 over k to the fourth times b4k. So it's going to involve a log of the lower limit and the upper limit of the integration. And so when we exponentiate that, that'll become a power of the ratio of lambda over little lambda. So it's going to be capital, it'll be little lambda divided by capital lambda to the capital A over 2 times E to the I curly G over 2, where capital A is minus 2 pi squared times the sum over n m of a to m, qn, qm divided by 2 pi to the fourth, beta nm, which I'll explain in a second, times the logarithm of 1 plus beta m, 1 minus beta m. And beta nm is the relative velocity of particle n and particle m. And that's a Lorentz invariant thing, because the velocity in any one frame is frame dependent. But if I have two particles and I ask what's the relative velocity, everybody agrees on that. And so that's what beta is. So it's something which is between 0 and 1. And curly G is, so it's 0 if a to n is not equal to a to m. So it's 0 if one of them is on the initial and one of them is final. But it's not 0 if they're both initial or both at final. And when it's not 0, it's 4 pi cubed the log of lambda sum over nm qn qm over 2 pi to the fourth.
So wait, what's the beta and m equals v, and what's the 3 index values?
Relative.
It's relative velocity, yeah. Okay. So the claim is that this phase is the Coulomb phase that you would have for the two particles in the initial state or the two particles in the final state if they had been, you know, in the presence of one another, as they would be if they're both in the initial or final state. But that drops out in a rate, so it's not going to play much of a role. But it would be there if you wanted to keep track of the interference of things, because it's the Coulomb, it's basically the Coulomb scattering phase. And this is the guy that matters from the point of view of rates. And so this is the guy that we're going to have to look at the canceling of this between the emission of photons for. But
it looks like something we find in special relativity called the rapidity.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's not quite. No, it's so the rapidity would have been 10h of beta would be v or something like that. There are b over c. Yeah, so that would be what I'm calling beta here. So this is really just the vrel divided by the speed of light, if I put the speed of light in.
Right.
So it's just, it's the, you know, beta, you go back to the 30s, beta is what they called v over c, because c wasn't one for them. So you couldn't just call it v. But that's kind of the history of that.
What is this relationship between beta and the p's?
So the way to do that is you go to the rest frame of one of them and ask what the velocity of the other one is. And so I can just tell you what the answer is, but that's how you derive it. So
it seems it seems fine to me to have this whatever early D's of exponential, but it seems very awkward to have this A as an exponential of a not an E.
A is an exponential of what?
A is the exponential of something that's not E. It's an exponential of something else.
Not E. Really, this thing.
Yeah. So that goes into the exponential of the base.
Yeah.
And then whatever you call this, the f or a j.
This a. So I'm not sure if what we're talking
about.
Goes there. Right. So this is just e to the a over two log of this, right? So this is an exponential of this.
Right. So you just think of it.
Yeah. In the same way I could have written this log as being lambda over lambda to the ig if I wanted to, but for imaginary things, that looks weirder. I want to give you your formula for the. If I had been, here it is. If I had been quicker on my feet, I would have just derived it in real life. But it's basically the statement is that beta. Beta nm, in terms of the four vectors, is the square root of 1 minus m1 squared. M2 squared divided by P1 dot P2 squared. And the way you derive that is you go to the rest frame of P2, evaluate P1 dot P2 in terms of the velocity of P1, and then solve for the velocity. So that's how you get that. So the thing I said about the Bremsstrahlung is what this real part is telling you. If you'd been a Jackson jock, you would have recognized this probably, is that you can, the rate that you could get when we do the, well, once we do the emission of the photons, you'll see that it's related to this because they're going to, this factor has to cancel the thing we're going to get when we sum over the photon emission. And so the same kind of thing is going to appear in the photon emission rate. And that's the thing that you classically would have had if you had particles go in, change direction instantaneously, and then if you ask classically what the Bremsstrahlung would have been, it's the thing that A would have controlled. And so it's a separate check on the, in this sum. All right, so now let me, in the last few seconds, just maybe tell you what the photon thing turns out to be. Is that doable? Actually, maybe because there's only 5 minutes left, I should start this next time. The next thing we're going to do is take the basic thing, this. And what we'll do is we'll calculate the polarization vector epsilon star mu1 k1 epsilon mu n star an times m beta alpha, and we'll calculate the square of it, and we'll sum over all the polarizations, lambda 1 lambda n, and we'll integrate d3k1 d3kn. And the fact that we're going to get something which is going to be similar isn't going to be a surprise, because the sum over lambdas, that's the thing that was giving you the tensor structure inside your propagator, right? That was sum of polarizations was what gave you delta mu nu. So that will look like the propagator we've been getting over there. And then these integrals, they're going to be the ones. So for every, we don't have to have an even number of one of these, but the every time we have a photon, we're going to have a factor of this, and so when we and relativistically, we always get a factor of the frequency for each one. So this goes like d3k over k, so it's going like two powers of k, and then when you square this, you get two more powers of k, and that's where the infrared divergences are coming from in the phase space integrals. And if you ask at any particular order in powers of alpha, what's happening? So at linear order in alpha, you've got the one soft loop that you did. That's the factor we would have got there if we'd stopped. If we expand this thing out as being, e to the something time, if I write this in power series in A and keep the thing that's linear in A, that would involve two powers of E. That'll be the one loop result. And that's going to compete with every time you emit a photon. There's a factor of E. So if you emit two of them, that'll be a factor of E squared once you square the rate. And so the balancing of the factors of alpha are going to come from that. And so that's what you're also doing an example of in your homework, where the hard scattering in that case will be you have a Coulomb potential and the electron scatters from it. So you calculate, that's a famous cross-section, the Mott cross-section. And then you just look at the emission of a photon from the various lines and then ask, what's the, how does that photon emission diverge? And then how does that compare to the radiative correction where you connect the, you have a pair of photons that are connecting, on those two external lines. So you're going to basically do what I've been doing here for the special case with this blob is just the Coulomb potential. And so you can get, that helps you see how this cancellation is going to go through. But the basic thing is these phase-based divergences with this rate squared are going to be canceling the square of this amplitude m tilde. So what we're going to do is we'll take m tilde beta alpha squared, and we'll add to it the sum over the emitting, n photons with energy less than some cutoff omega mn squared. And the thing is that we're not adding the amplitudes, we're adding the rates, because those are distinguishable final states in principle. And so the statement is that the coefficients of the logarithmic divergence here are exactly, there's a factor here which is diverging, that factor, and you're going to get the same factor appearing here. And the fact that they got the same factor allows you to kind of see that they're going to cancel one another. This will involve the logarithm of, say, lambda over little lambda. This will involve the logarithm of some physical thing like the resolution of your detector divided by little lambda. And then when you add them together, the lambdas will cancel and you'll be left with something like the hard scale divided by the energy of your detector. And that's the finite thing you're going to get. And it'll depend logarithmically on this ratio, which is a physical thing in your problem. And let's do that next time. Next time, the goal is a heroic goal. So the goal was to finish this and then to do vacuum polarization so that we could do some of these ultraviolet things more explicitly. And I'll get as far as I can on that. Probably what I'll do is quote a lot of answers. I'll just set up we'll do the vacuum polarization. I'll define dimensional regularization, make the point about infrared versus ultraviolet, and then tell you what the answer is for these various graphs. And when we integrate out the muon, that's a concrete example of a heavy thing that you integrate out, and you can ask, how does it affect things at low energies, like in QED?